Grief is the conversation that no one wants, but everyone will need at some point in their life. Losing my youngest son, Murray, in 2019, as he had just turned 22 years old, has been and is the single most challenging thing I have ever faced. And the guests on the Good Grief Conversation help me with that challenge every day, and they make the journey just that little bit easier. I hope that the open and honest conversation you will hear will help you too. Welcome to the Good Grief Conversation, here on UK Health Radio. I'm your host, Janet Jones. Going back to that fateful, life-altering day, the 14th of July, 2019, when the meteorite once again hit my world and blasted it apart into a trillion tiny particles. In fact, probably even more particles than that. I wondered if I would ever be happy again. How could I? Without my baby boy. He was 22, but he will always be my baby. I recall thinking, there must be a way back to happiness. Life cannot now be misery to my dying day. So I read ferociously to find the answers and the way forward to bringing happiness back somehow, no matter how small. But this was the journey that I really needed to go on. One of the books that I read was It's Okay That You're Not Okay by Megan Devine. And that was good because I was far from okay. So far, in fact, that I didn't know what okay was. People would say to me, you know, are you okay? How are you doing? Are you okay? And I would look and I was like, I don't know, because I don't actually know what okay now means. I knew what okay meant in my old life, but in this new world where everything had been completely obliterated, even okay wasn't available for me to know what it was. You know, I functioned and that was it in those dark, pressured days. Now, the book wasn't giving me what I was looking for. On page 7, she says, not everything has a silver lining. And I was like, oh, please do not tell me that. I needed to know that there might be at least a silver-ish lining. And the author goes on to say, you are not okay. You might never be okay. I was devastated. Murray wouldn't want his mama to suffer. I was afraid I may never find out how to be more than okay. And I, first of all, I had to figure out what okay was. Now, the truth is, both you and I will at least be okay. Because okay is such a low bar. Now, you might not feel okay right now, and that is fine. In fact, it's how it should be. Who would be okay when the life as they knew it had lost its foundations? Heck, not even just the foundations, but the whole structure of life had disappeared. Nobody is going to be okay when that happens. Now, I knew at the time that I would have to have something positive in my life. It's just who I am. But even if I didn't believe it, I needed to start thinking of it. You see, before Murray's accident, I worked as a happiness expert. I'm an author of a book on happiness. I would teach happiness techniques, and I was known as the happiness millionaire, and regularly in the media and on the radio. I even had a short TV appearance. But part of the happiness training was understanding the power of the subconscious mind and how the language that we use, both out loud and in our mind, will shape how our life goes. Now, I knew that if you tell yourself something over and over again, it will, in time, become the truth. And that is simply how the subconscious mind works. It's a massive thing to understand, and actually, it is a life-changing thing to understand. So, in my darkest hours, and I mean in my darkest hours, this was at the very, very beginning, I came up with this idea that I would get the chalk out, and at the side of my bed, I had a plain wall. It was like an olive green colour. And I came up with this idea that I was going to chalk things on there so that the dark words in my head could be challenged and they could be overwritten. So I took the chalk out, and before going to sleep, it is the most influential time for the subconscious mind. So I would glance at these words before I slept, and I would see them when I very first woke in the morning. Now, I'll tell you what I wrote in a moment, but trust me, there wasn't 1 ounce of me that believed it when I scribbled on the wall. But I knew that if I was going to be okay, and hopefully way more than okay one day, then I just had to trust I was doing the right thing. So, dressed in my fleecy dressing gown, probably had slippers, probably hadn't showered for days, my hair a mess, I decided to write on the wall. So I took the chalk, and in big letters, I wrote, "I believe." Now, of course, at that time, I didn't believe. I wanted to die. But again, like I said, I knew the power of what it was I was doing. So I wrote the words, "I believe." Okay, what does that mean? To me, it meant that I believe in life. I believe in nature. And I believe in the power of the human spirit to survive, and not only survive, but actually create big changes, even in the most tragic circumstances. So for me, that is what the words "I believe" meant. I also wrote words from my son Murray, said, "You got this, Mama." He always called me Mama. And then I placed one of my favourite pictures of him on the wall. Above it, I wrote, "Ma raison d'être." And then I wrote my 3 children's names underneath. I remember feeling this sense of something else to write, and it felt like the sense was coming from Murray. And he wanted me to write, "I love you, Mama." And so every day, morning, night, and several times throughout the day, because I did a lot of sleeping, I would see these words. Now, sometimes I'd feel angry at them also, and I didn't believe them, but I just kept them there. Sometimes I didn't even read them, but just knowing that they were there had a huge impact. So I continued with this process because for me, it was not okay that I may never be okay. See, I knew it was up to me, but I also knew it was going to be a long journey. You know, don't get me wrong, this is not a quick thing to do. This is a long journey. But I knew that it was up to me. And also, I would regularly read a quote by Maya Angelou that also challenged me when all I wanted to do was scream. And she says, "You may not control all that happens to you, but you can decide not to be reduced by them." And those words were just so powerful and, you know, helped me. Now, there were times they didn't help me. I had to go through the pain, but that's what I read that would just keep me slightly afloat. On days when I'm feeling not okay, I have dragged myself out for a walk, forced myself to do yoga, or gone to do something to distract me. Now, there are some days that really I should have just stayed in bed. That is what I discovered. Either that or eat a tub of ice cream. Now, we are all very different, and our grief experience is as different and unique as we are. And this is your journey. And the people who are in the ring, they know that there is no advice or words that will help when you're in a dark place. But something to eat, a hug, a hot drink, and a sign that says, I see you and I am with you. It doesn't need to be said. Actions speak louder than words. Also, words can be very clunky and often inappropriate. In fact, sometimes words, they just do not express how you feel or what you want to say. We always want to help people out of their pain, but you have to feel it to heal it. The only way out is through. Now, that was another quote that helped me to keep my head above water and helped me to understand that, you know, don't ignore the pain. Don't do things to soften the pain. Fall into the pain. Lean into it and let it have you for a while. But just know that the pain is for a while. So you do have to feel it to heal it. And the only way out really is through. But people who love you and just want you to feel better instantly will say things to cheer you up. But grief doesn't need cheering up. Grief requires holding. It requires feeling, acknowledging, and accepting. But how do you do that if you constantly distract yourself or are surrounded by people who want to cheer you up? These are all well-meaning people, but as Brené Brown says, they are not in the ring. I was incredibly fortunate to have many amazing people in my life. People would reach out to me and offer things like Reiki sessions, EFT, which is emotional freedom technique, also known as tapping. And I had people offering yoga, all for free, because they understood that their services would be very useful and helpful to me. You know, even if it's just starting off to do something to make a difference. And I could go to them as long as I needed it. So I was truly, truly grateful. I also had friends who would sit in my tragically sad space and not feel uncomfortable, but just hold my hand while witnessing my heart breaking. I had fabulous family and friends who would come over with food and help with keeping my house running. You know, the things that you just can't do for yourself. It's amazing when you lose the foundations of your life. Keeping your house in order and eating, they form part of your foundation. And these are all essential things. And they all say, I love you. You are special. I had a great conversation with Dave, my yoga teacher, and Tracy, who introduced me to the EFT, which I still use. And so here are a few highlights from that show that have really helped me. What is it about the either stretching or breathing? What's it doing to us as a human being?
Well, it's the mind-body connection. And really the aim of yoga, or the kind of goal of yoga, is to stop this kind of inner chatter, or, you know, the mind being sort of all over the place.
Which is where the stress and everything comes from, isn't it? The stuff that's going on in the head, you know, that constant, like you say, constant chatter, the fear, living in the past, living in the future. So maybe bringing ourselves into this present moment is the thing that actually makes us be able to see what is around us in that present moment.
Living in the past, living in the future, blah, blah, blah. This is what we all probably do. A practice of something like yoga or meditation, what it does, and obviously it's, you know, a 1,000-year-old practice, is that it brings you into the present moment, you know. So through listening to the breath, paying attention to your body and what it feels like internally, you don't go anywhere else. Obviously there's times, like my own practice this morning, I was really distracted. The first 20 minutes were really good, and then the next 20 minutes was all over the place, and then I got through that, and then it got back again, ups and downs and ups and downs. But through practice, through repetition, you get better at the concentration, you get better at being present, you know, for that however long your practice is.
I think it's really good to practice all of this before tragedy strikes, because all of our lives are all up and down. You know, nobody has a blissful life from the second they're born to the moment they die. It is a journey of ups, downs, life lessons, loves, joys, pains. It is all of that. My massive lesson for the value of the breath was my son lost his breath. And that's the key, isn't it? It's like we put so much value on so many other things. And the one thing that we take for granted, that we think we'll wake up in the morning and we'll still be able to do, and that is breathing. And so for me, you teaching me to focus on breath has really brought my awareness to that, and brings me to the present moment, and fills me with gratitude as well. Because you just think, I can still breathe, which means I can still live. What a gift.
So within the practice of yoga, we call it prana, and it means life energy. And so the practice of the asana is to develop prana. So the life energy within your body will increase. And so, you know, through the practice of this deep breathing and the asanas and the movement.
What's asana?
So sorry, asana is posture, prana is breath, or this life energy. And so within the practice, whenever you combine the posture, the breath, and the movement, so that's the vinyasa, these three things, when they're linked together, that brings about the kind of holy trinity, I guess, of magical stuff, you know. And then on a deeper physical level, it's actually helping to kind of cleanse your like nervous system. You're trying to unleash blockages that are there and all of these things. So again, this is kind of, you know, deeper sort of philosophical levels of the yoga practice. That's why we're doing, like, you know, you're doing twists, you're doing all this stuff with the spine, is to allow the energy, allow the prana to flow up and down your body.
This tapping is kind of linked to understanding like acupuncture and things.
It's connected to all that Chinese medicine, acupuncture, acupressure, qigong.
So rather than having needles stuck in you, you can just tap yourself. It sounds so much better.
And that's why I fell in love with EFT, because it's very portable. You can be anywhere and use it. It's a tool and a technique I can teach my clients, so that even outside the room that I'm in with them, that they can, whenever they're feeling flooded with a strong emotion that they can't see past, that they can just simply reduce it by tapping on strategic points of their body. It's such an amazing technique.
So let's come back to the meridian points and talk us through where they are and what they mean.
Oh, I don't know what they mean. I just know where they are.
Okay, well, let's just stick with where they are.
Right. So we have the top point is at the top of the crown of the head. This is a major tapping point. We have the beginning of the eyebrow, the side of the eye, which the side of the eye relates to the vagus nerve. And then we have the under the eye. So we have three points around. So it's on the bone of around the eye.
So just let people imagine that they're tapping the top of the head, above their eyebrow, at the side of the eye, and then just underneath of the eye.
So after underneath the eye, there's below the nose and above the lip there, in that little dip that we have there. And then we have the dip in the chin,
okay,
just below the lip. And then we have an area just under the collarbone. It's about 1 inch down. And your arm, like if you hold your arms bag, it just reaches the right place. They land perfectly there, so you tap there. And that is also, in respect of grief, it's also very close to the heart, which is where we feel all that sadness. So that is a very good place for grief, even just any time of the day. Watching TV, just sit there and tap that, lightly tapping, and it can really help. And after, under the collarbone, there's the, for ladies, the bra strap spot.
So it's at the side of your body, isn't it?
It's at the side, yeah. So you just tap. I know that that area is the spleen in Chinese medicine. And then we have points on the hand and wrist. And these are really useful points because you can tap very discreetly in public using the points on the hand. You tap first the wrist.
By the nail, at the side of the thumbnail.
And then the top of the thumb, and you tap through all your fingers. So that's around from the top of the head, right round through to the little finger. You can actually press on this point here, which is called the gamut point, and it's between your wedding ring finger and your little finger there on your hand. If you just press there and take a few deep breaths, very soothing.
A few days after Murray's accident, I met up with one of my oldest friends, Teo Akinbody. Teo is a musician and he writes music for TV programs. He does work with the RSC and many other theatre productions. In fact, Teo and I, we go back a very long way. And we met in the theatre back in the early 80s and we have been great friends ever since. In fact, he even wrote the music for this show, which I truly appreciate. It's beautiful. The thing is, Teo has his own story of grief, and he truly understood. So he would just sit in silence with me as I literally cried and wept all over him, either in public or in private. He never once tried to find answers or to cheer me up. He simply sat with me. Now, here he is talking to me about losing his parents as a young boy and then his brother.
So it was a fairly happy childhood up until, I guess, about the age of 7. That's when it all started to change. So my dad had been ill for a while. I didn't know what he was ill with, but he was in and out of hospital. And then in the final part of his life, he was in hospital for quite a few months. And so when I was 7, and he was quite young, he was 45, he died of bowel cancer. At the time, I don't know why, I thought it was stomach cancer. I'm sure they told me it was stomach cancer. I only found out relatively recently it was bowel cancer. So yeah, so that was, he was quite young. We were all quite young. So that was in 68. So I remember the first thought that came into my head when my dad died. The first thought was that, oh, I'm halfway to being an orphan. I don't know why that thought came into my head, but I remember it to this very day. It just straight into my head.
Amazing, isn't it? And we wonder sometimes where those kind of random thoughts even come from, but they seem to drop
in. They do. It wasn't like I knew lots of orphans or anything like that. In fact, I don't think I knew any. So obviously, that sort of thing was kind of, you know, rife in literature, Oliver and, you know, all those kind of things. So, yeah, and the concept of the orphan, obviously, we all know about that.
And also, I guess, age 7, that is the age where children are becoming very conscious of their parents and, you know, and life really. And they'll have heard at that point of, you know, people dying and stuff. So we're just becoming more aware at the age of 7. So maybe it was an awareness that made you think that.
Possibly. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe it was an awareness. Maybe it was a foresight. Who can say?
Yes. Yeah. Maybe it was.
Anyway, so then followed three good years. My mum was amazing. My mum was an amazing woman. She was a sort of sunny woman. She was a nurse. She worked really, really hard. And she just worked really, really hard for 3 children. And I have strong memories of her just always working. She was a nurse and a district nurse. And I remember once a week, she used to have to go to the clinic and do an evening session at the clinic. And every now and then she'd take me with her. And I remember the biggest treat about going to that clinic was stationery.
Stationery
covered. I used to come out with pens and pencils. and rubbers. That was a big treat for a seven-year-old in those days. Maybe it still is. And actually, my daughter was quite into stationery. Yeah. Anyway, so 3 years with my mum. So it was a Friday night, and me and my brother. My brother was 5 years older than me. My sister was 6 years older than me. So by this time, I was 10, brother 15, sister 16. So, and we were watching telly on a Friday night. And my brother went into the kitchen to get a drink or something. And I just heard a scream. I just remember a scream. So me and my sister ran off to see what happened. And my mum had collapsed. She collapsed in the kitchen. It turned out that it was a stroke. So she couldn't get up. She wasn't a small woman, my mum. So she couldn't get up. And already there was some paralysis down the side of her face. I remember as well, because I remember trying to say, I'll be all right. I'm all right. I'm all right. But it was kind of slurred. So this was pretty terrifying. And I think my brother or my sister said, call uncle, because we had an uncle who, Uncle Tunde, who used to hang out with us quite a lot. So I called uncle and called an ambulance. And then I sat at the top of the stairs. I couldn't go back in the kitchen. So I just sat at the top of the stairs and waiting for someone else to arrive or something to arrive. So yeah, my uncle did arrive. An ambulance did arrive. And my mum went to hospital. She managed another week and a half. So I remember the last time I saw her was a week Saturday after she'd gone in. So it was a week and a day. And she was on pretty good form. She was kind of smiling. She was sort of holding court. I remember that we were there. There were relatives and family friends all around. And, you know, obviously she was still slurring, but she was kind of smiling and joking. And she was on really, really good form. But yeah, that was the last time I saw her. So she died the Wednesday after. So a week and a half after a stroke. I think she must have had another stroke. And so then I was an orphan.
At 10 years old.
Yeah. I was talking about my brother and my auntie. Their relationship was beautiful, actually. It was a lovely thing to see that my auntie got on so well with my brother, which is great. So 2 years later, my brother got ill. So he went to hospital for tests. And so this was by this time, I'm 12, he's 17. So it turned out that he had leukemia. I don't know if I knew it was leukemia. Maybe I did know it was leukemia or I don't know. Anyway, I just knew he was ill. I didn't know the seriousness of his illness. I didn't know the gravity of it. I just knew he was ill. But, you know, people get ill. People come out of hospital. They get better, like young people, like old people. Exactly. Because I mean, my experience was that old people get ill, go to hospital and die. Yeah. But young people, yeah, they get ill and they just, you know, they come out, they grow up, they live long, don't they, though?
Especially young people, yeah.
And my brother was always, he was just always still in such good spirits. He was such a jolly lad. Lost his hair, got a wig, wore a wig for a while, the funniest wig. But so he was rocking that bald head. He looked good. It was about 3 or 4 months that he lived with it. And then that summer he died, which was a huge shock. When my mum died, I had the thought of, I'm halfway to an orphan. I never thought that anything would happen to my brother. He's my big brother. So that was probably an even bigger shock than my mum dying, I would say. And because he was my big brother, I mean, I idolized him from the moment I was born.
Can imagine. And he's one of you, isn't he?
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You know, your siblings, you're a little team, and he's your team. Whereas parents, they're kind of in another team.
We're the three Akin bodies. We're the ones who are left with the other family, with the Ulul family.
So the bond had been intensified beyond normal sibling relationships, hadn't it?
And even because we're the boys, even me and he are the team against my sister sometimes. I mean, my poor sister. Sometimes we'll gang up against her because she's the oldest, she's the big one. That was a huge blow.
It's massive. And I remember Lewis, you know, with losing his little brother, you know, and he said he felt he'd lost half of himself because people always referred to them as the boys. So they're like a single unit, really. So it's always Iona and the boys. It was never Iona and Lewis and Murray. It was always the boys.
Exactly. Your children are the same setup as us three, aren't they? So
same setup, yeah. So it's a huge wrench.
Yeah, it was huge. It was absolutely huge.
So you were 12 at that time. How does little 12-year-old Theo handle that one?
By retreating into himself, I guess. So I learned a recorder as an 11-year-old, and like it's like a light shining out the sky, heavenly choir looking down on me, even though I wasn't believing God by then, because like...
That sealed the deal then.
Yeah, like when my brother died, that was it with me in religion. It's like, okay, yeah, that was it. Like, there can't be an intelligent design to this life that we're all living in. You know, we watched the news and I'd seen what had gone on in Biafra. I remember seeing those children with the distended bellies and the flies over them as they were dying of starvation. And so how can you tell me there's a God when you've got those children who have done nothing to anybody, dying the most pitiful, agonizing death? So for me, it's like, and then my brother just put a tin hat on it. It's like, nah, it's not having that. So, but what I did believe in was music. I believed in music. I believe in people. I believe in love, and I believe in music. And this teacher, yeah, he opened the world of music to me. And I went on from one instrument to another, and I had found my thing. You know, some people live a long time before they find their thing. But I was lucky that at the age of 11, I found my thing.
And that thing saved you.
That saved me. Yeah, it absolutely saved me.
In my struggle to ever feel happiness again and my search for a life that could be more than okay, I found amazing, inspiring people to talk to so that I might see the light ahead. Or if I couldn't see it, just know that it is there somewhere because it was there for other people. And if it was there for others, I had to believe that the light was also going to be there for me. Two of the most inspiring women I have spoken to who turned their tragedy into a purpose were Wendy Black Stern and Ashley Jones. Both Wendy and Ashley lost young children. Wendy lost her son Noah at just age 9 months, and Ashley lost her daughter Skylar at nearly two. So I have put together some of their comments that have stuck with me and helped me to live a more inspired life, and I hope that they help you to achieve the same. Now, not every day is an inspired day though, and as Wendy says, there is always a dance between the light and the dark.
I think like many people who kind of have a path that's led by purpose, my initiation into grief work was very much through my own experience. And sometimes it's hard to say where the journey really began, but a significant part of my story is a huge experience I had of losing my first child. My son Noah passed away when he was 9 months old, and that really led me on a journey of self-discovery and of healing to figure out how to deal with this big loss.
Do you think that's what grief ultimately does? That it opens you up somehow to discover more of yourself?
I think it certainly has that potential. In my own life and what I witness in the people that I work with is that it is a powerful catalyst for our own becoming, in a sense, for not only self-discovery, but for our own personal transformation. And I know for me, it was like my world was shattered. It was like the rug being taken out from underneath. And there's a process that you go through of feeling, at least for me, completely lost. It affects identity. It affects every aspect of our being. Part of my story is that after Noah passed away. My husband and I, within 2 weeks of his death, we set out on a really big pilgrimage, in a sense. And we left the States and we traveled to Southeast Asia. We landed first in Bali, Indonesia, and then continued on to Thailand. And what we experienced in those cultures has been incredibly impactful for me and has in many ways informed my kind of personal path as well as professional path in supporting people with grief. We discovered a lot through these travels, but the biggest thing that has really stuck with me was just the way people received us in our grief and the culture's relationship to death and to grief.
Right. I know, you know, the response to grief does vary around the world. In the West, we seem to like a pain-free life. And so, you know, see people suffering, immediately we want them to feel better. What is that like in these Eastern countries?
People weren't afraid of it. They weren't uncomfortable with our pain. They weren't uncomfortable with our grief. They weren't uncomfortable with the topic of death, for they really do view death as a part of life. And so there's a level of acceptance and understanding that allow them to really lean in towards us, to be open to hear our story, to be open to be in connection with us while we're in pain, rather than looking away, rather than kind of avoiding our eyes because it was uncomfortable. There was just a gentleness and an openness to it that really allowed us to grieve, to talk about what we were feeling and to be able to kind of be in the world without having to pull in towards ourselves or isolate and to hide our suffering. And that was a big contrast to what we felt in the United States, where, you know, we have been blessed to have a beautiful community of family and friends who showed up. The culture in general was uncomfortable with our pain. No one knew how to talk to us or how to be with us. No one wanted to say Noah's name. It was like there was always the big elephant in the room. And part of the reason we like left the country was that it was suffocating to kind of be feeling everyone's discomfort with our pain. And when we came home, you know, it was hard to reintegrate. It was hard to be back in our world that was, for us, forever changed, to come back to life without Noah. But we carried on because that's what you do. And I think grief opens us to our humanity. It literally, in my experience, will break your heart open. And in that heartbreak, even though it hurts a lot, there's an opportunity to extend our capacity for love. We actually learn to feel.
And that's the hard bit, because people look at you and they see on the outside the same person, that you look the same, you walk the same, you dress the same, but my goodness, you're not the same.
And that's a really painful place to be, because you can feel very misunderstood. And it's like, it's hard when you're feeling something on the inside and the outside world is not acknowledging or reflecting that change. I had an experience on the massage table with a dear friend where I was talking about exactly what we're talking about here, like my confusion of like, who am I now? I'm not that. And I felt confused. I felt lost. I felt very much afraid and really struggling with how unknown everything was. And she named this place for me where I was in myself as the tunnel of terror. And for me, it was terrifying. Some of you may have a different name for the tunnel, but the tunnel represents the in-between. The in-between place of, well, I'm no longer that, yet I don't know yet who I'm becoming. In the tunnel, it's dark. It's cold often. It's unknown. It's scary. It's lonely. It is a hard place to be. And it is also the cocoon of the butterfly, right? And I actually have come out of it more me than I've ever been, even though it may look different, because it doesn't have all the hangups, right? It doesn't have all of the self-limiting beliefs and all that. And of course, there are days where I find myself back in the tunnel. I'm not saying that this is like there's an end point, right?
I don't know why I went through what I just went through. I don't have that answer, but I also know I don't really need that answer to do something with it. So it's like, I know that I have all of these skills. I know respiratory therapy. I know GI nursing. I know physical therapy for all of her treatments that I had to do at home. I understand what it's like to go through the terminal diagnosis and the death. I know so much about what helped me in my grief. And so really, I just sat and thought, well, okay, I'm still breathing. So I held her as she stopped breathing. And it was one of those things where I felt her take her last breath and I felt her heart stop beating. And it was one of those moments where I understood why people die of a broken heart. Like, it was so painful. And I was like, why am I still breathing? But part of me was like, all right, well, I'm still breathing. So what can I do with this? Why am I still breathing? I really sat and thought about it because, you know, for 2 years, I had been a full-time mom and caregiver. And so I really was struggling with my identity. So I really considered like going back to nursing school because, again, I had all of a lot of medical knowledge on how to care for fragile, terminally diagnosed people, especially with kids. I was like, maybe I should be a pediatric nurse. I don't know. The more I was like, you know, there are lots of other nurses out there, but like no one's really talking about grief. And no one's helping people grieve, and no one's helping the community figure out what to do with those people either. Like our community, we had some incredible people show up and really like stick it out with us, but we had so many people disappear.
Because they can't handle it.
Right. That for me was like, we need to fix that. When you're in it, you don't have the choice to step away.
In fact, you have to step in. In fact, I was talking to someone today, and we were talking about how death and grief, it's hidden away. But it is part of life, because I'm living, and this is where I'm at. And it can be any one of us. Now, I'm an ordinary woman. And as you were just going through life, we're doing what everyone tells us we should do to be good citizens. And, you know, that horrible thing happens. And, you know, and I get the feeling that you're the same with Skylar. It's hard to say that that is a horrible thing because it's to do with the people we love the most. It's their journey too.
Well, and I think too, like it's our part of our purpose for existing because, you know, you wouldn't be where you are and I wouldn't be where I am and we would not be having this conversation. If not, you know, and so one of the things that I realized is the stories that we tell ourselves and the actual words that we use really matter to our ability to heal or stay in pain. For example, like what you said, that our experience is terrible. Like that's painful language that doesn't really honor what we went through and can keep us in a painful mindset. In the raw grief, like when you first lose the person you love, it's natural to be in that just awful pain. And so using language like that can be really helpful to just get the pain out. But I think where people get stuck in their grief, sometimes the language holds us back. I would hear myself saying like, oh yeah, she was taken from me too soon. Like a piece of me died that day and I'll never get it back. Early on, that adequately and accurately described how I was feeling. But over time, I knew that if I held on to that narrative, it would actually keep me in that place of pain. What I tried to do was to intentionally shift my language. Even if I didn't feel it, it was like, no, I believe that she came to fulfill her purpose. And her purpose was accomplished in 21 months. And so like that makes me feel so much more proud that like my daughter came and she got it done. But also like her purpose was partly in waking me up.
Aren't those informative conversations? Now, they are a long way ahead in this grief journey, so we should never compare where we are and feel that we aren't doing very well. You see, even now, I often struggle with the motivation to get out of bed in the morning. But to help me out, just recently, I have started to write my list the night before of what I need to do the following day. And this helps me to spend less time in a daze, for starters. But it also somehow in my mind has a little preparation for the day ahead, and maybe that has a little drop of motivation. But When I woke this morning and saw my list, I felt overwhelmed by it, and I reminded myself that though there was a lot on the list, I only have to do one thing to move forward. Now, in the early days, I would actually watch myself do things, and if I did something like wash the dishes, brush my hair, do my teeth, I would tell myself, well done. Wherever possible, I would recognize the good things I had done. And when there were times I needed to hide away and sleep, I would tell myself not to worry because I was doing so well. And I would say that even when it appeared that I wasn't. You see, this is self-love. I guess it's becoming your own best friend. Now, over time, the dialogue changes, but then it can also revert back. And all of that is fine. This is the dance with the darkness, one step at a time. In the book, Finding Meaning, The Sixth Stage of Grief, which is a book by David Kessler, and he's a psychiatrist, a grief counsellor, and sadly, he also lost his son. And I would actually say that it's one of the best books on grief that I have ever read. I do think there's a timing for the book, but the time wherever you are at within your grief. But for me, this one, I guess it arrived at the right time, and it's been superb. And in there, he talks about when people jump into meaning prematurely. So when early on they set up charities and causes and things like that, I could see myself in that and thought, you know, maybe that's what I did with the good grief conversation. Now, it was the right time to do it, and it was definitely the right thing. The journey that I've been on with this conversation has certainly helped me, and I do hear from people where they share that, you know, these conversations helped to make them stronger and it gave them hope. So it was definitely the right thing to do. But in his book, he talks about having to recalibrate the grief. So you can't rush grief, and it is important to recognize it, acknowledge it, and work with it. So it's because of that that I realized that, you know, maybe doing this every single week for the rest of my life is possibly going to be a little too much and won't allow me to deal with my grief, to comfort my grief and allow it to become part of my growth. So I've decided that I'm going to run the Good Grief Conversation in seasons. So next week's show is going to be the last in the very first series of the Good Grief Conversation. And we will be back in spring in 2021 with more inspiring conversation where we can look at growing through grief and help people even more. And I do believe with the break, you know, when you have breaks from things, it allows you to step back and be even more creative with the process. So I believe that is what will happen with doing the seasons as opposed to continually doing them. So the plan is that we do two seasons per year, both of 12 weeks. So that will be 24 conversations per year. And I think that will be really a rich conversation. So I hope that you will join me in 2021 for more conversation. But before we do finish this season, I do have one more guest, and my final guest, which will be aired next week, the 5th of January, and her name is Suzanne Falter. And she's very inspiring. She's an author from California in America. And she also lost her daughter, Teal. I think she was age 22, similar to my son. And she has written a fantastic book, several fantastic books, in fact. But this particular one is called Surrender to Joy. And it is about, you know, how her approach to losing her daughter, Teal, and how that has inspired her life. Now, it was my good friend Nikki Pattinson who was on my show on week 3, and Nikki lost her son Jackson just at the age of 4.5 months. So that's a superb conversation if you find yourself in that situation and you want to re-listen. That's episode 3. But Suzanne is a friend of Nikki's, and at the time when I lost Murray, Nikki asked Suzanne if she would send me a copy of her book, which she did. And what it did for me was give me hope. I didn't know when I would be in a position to take action on Suzanne's book, but it did give me hope that I would get there one day. So next week is my conversation with Suzanne talking about that very thing, the hope that her book gives to people. So that's the book, Surrender to Joy. We'll be back next week with that conversation, and that will be the last one in this season, but we will be back. In the meantime, you know, do go to www.thegoodgriefconversation.com and sign up for the podcast extras, where all my lovely guests have offered gifts to help with your healing journey and to help you with growing through grief. I'm your host, Janet Jones, and it's been my absolute pleasure.